fired back open. A faint noise, something indistinct but vaguely familiar, grabbed his attention. There was no way he would have heard it without the walker's game ear increasing his hearing, but still, it barely registered. While his brain was processing the origin of the sound, he heard it again, soft but unmistakable. A slight scratching. A mouse? No. Yes. He knew what it was now. It was a plastic buckle, probably a Fastec, commonly used on tactical gear. Cort had worn equipment adorned with Fastec buckles for the majority of his life, so he knew the sound they made when they touched other surfaces almost as well as he knew his own inner voice. The buckle had brushed against the wooden wall on the little patio of his basement apartment, right next to the cement steps up to the driveway. Now Cort concentrated, listened beyond the ever-increasing sound of his own pounding heart, and he detected footsteps just outside his door. He pictured the scene just 6 feet from where he now lay. A half-dozen SWAT officers filed down the steps, then, one by one, they stacked up on the wall right outside his door. One of the men accidentally bumped his drop-leg ammunition pouch on the wall as he moved into position, brushing the buckle against the wood. Cort reached for his gun. Chapter 49. Arthur Mayberry shook his head in disbelief, but Bernice Mayberry nodded her head as if she had known all along. They both sat in plastic chairs in an all-night laundromat 3 blocks from their home. Arthur wore his pajamas and a blue jacket handed to him by an ambulance driver. He stared ahead, still unable to process what was happening around him, and Bernice sat next to him in her housecoat, equal measures scared and angry. But she had already professed herself to be wholly unsurprised by tonight's events. Out through the windows of the laundromat, law enforcement officers stood around, radios to ears. On the street, ambulances and paddy wagons idled, and first responders waited for the order to roll forward. Arthur and his wife had been roused by a phone call just after 3 a.m., asking them both to very quickly and quietly come to the front door to speak with police officers. They'd complied, of course, and when they did, they were told they needed to leave their home immediately. Bernice had demanded to know what was going on, and an officer said there was a chemical spill on the nearby train tracks, and everything would be explained at the command center. They were whisked away by a team of armed cops in body armor and taken here to the laundromat, where dozens of cops were already set up, and whatever they were planning on doing didn't look to Arthur like it had one damn thing to do with a chemical spill. Guns, grenade launchers, night vision equipment, riot shields. Arthur hadn't seen so much military gear since Saigon in 1969. He and his wife were led to seats near the front of the laundromat, and as a group of cops parted to let them through, Arthur saw a large photograph of his basement tenant posted on cardboard and leaning against the wall.
"Oh, hell no," Mayberry mumbled under his breath.
15 minutes had passed since then, and now Arthur watched while the police looked over his hand-drawn diagram of his basement, including the corner apartment he built with his own two hands. He imagined when this was all over he was going to be in some serious trouble for all his building code violations, but he looked on the bright side. He sure as hell wasn't nearly in as much trouble as Jeff Duncan. He'd done what he could to deflect blame away from the man in his basement. Jeff Duncan was probably up to no good, but the very idea the mild-mannered white man living on his property was some sort of terrorist was asinine. Arthur had seen something in the man's face— a world weariness, a hardened interior, maybe. But he wasn't as bad as all this, Arthur felt sure. Bernice, on the other hand, kept muttering to herself that she knew Jeff Duncan was low down and no account, and she berated her husband mercilessly for not seeing this for himself. The Washington Metro Police Department refers to its SWAT unit as ERT, the Emergency Response Team. The head of the ERT unit had sat down with Mayberry a few minutes earlier and asked,
"You are certain there is no access to the house from the basement apartment?"
"Look, young man, I told the other officers,
I built that place myself. You would need to knock a hole in the wall to get into the basement. And even if you could bust through, you'd be over there on the other side with the furnace and the water heater.
Arthur had then drawn up the diagram, and although the police seemed to be very concerned about the man in the basement, Arthur could tell the emergency response team captain was glad he wouldn't have to split his men and hit multiple entrances at the same time. They could instead enter the basement, and then, if the subject wasn't there, they could exit and re-enter the home to clear it. Another 30 police officers were on the scene and charged with cordoning off the block to keep anyone from entering or exiting. If the cordon around the property was any good, and their suspect was inside, they'd get him, wherever they found him. Now Arthur and Bernice sat quietly, waiting for the tactical officers to get on with their raid and remove their tenant from their home in handcuffs, so they could go back home and back to bed. Denny Carmichael awoke from a deep sleep on his sofa. The phone on his desk trilled, and he grabbed it, both surprised and hopeful.
"Mays?"
"It's Brewer, sir."
She sounded almost out of breath.
"Talk."
"DC emergency response team has surrounded a house in Columbia Heights. They think they have the suspect from the DuPont Circle holed up inside."
Carmichael clenched the receiver tight.
"And why do they think this?"
"A Crime Stoppers tip led them to the area. Detectives came out and interviewed neighbors, showing them a picture taken from the Easy Market, and another taken at DuPont. They got a hit, apparently."
"And why are we just learning about this now?"
"We aren't monitoring tip line calls. There are 100 every hour, most all of them useless. We only monitor the radio traffic of dispatched police units. This call went over a landline directly to a supervisor and not out over the radio. He used his mobile phone to send out detectives. They weren't dispatched regularly. I guess they are suspicious a terrorist might be listening into police radio traffic. When they decided it was a legit lead, they called everyone out. We're a good 20 minutes behind the action."
Carmichael was furious the TOC hadn't accounted for the possibility the DC police would have a special protocol set up for Crime Stoppers tips.
"Where is JSOC?"
"En route, but they won't make it in time. ERT is going to hit that house any second."
"Give me the address, now!"
She did so. Carmichael hung up, and immediately he called Merkwin Alcazaz. If ERT attacked, Court might die, but if he lived and escaped, the Saudis needed to put themselves in position in time to cut him down. The worst-case scenario for Carmichael, anyway, was for Gentry to be taken alive by Washington, D.C. law enforcement. The thought of Court Gentry secure in a jail cell, talking to a public defender, made his stomach boil with acid.
"D.C. Metro Police Department, search warrant!"
Court opened the small hatch just as the shout came from outside his front door. He knew the cops weren't going to wait for him to answer, and he was right. 1 second after the call came, he heard a shotgun blast. A slug was fired into one of the hinges of the storm door. A second shot came 1 second later, and the door fell from the frame. A battering ram would crash through the wooden door any second. But Court wasn't waiting around for that. He had the hidden escape hatch door out of the way, and he pushed his backpack through the hole. Then he backed into it and reached for the hatch door to pull it back into place. The battering ram slammed into the wooden door of his apartment as he did so. The chair propped under the knob held for the first strike of the ram, and even the second. But as Court reseated the hatch and backed into the basement proper, he heard the chair break fully and the door crash in. And then he heard another noise, followed by just exactly what he expected would come next. He heard the screams of men. The ERT team leader was fourth in the stack of 8 men. He kept his M4 rifle high and his gloved left hand on the shoulder of the man in front of him. As the breech man smashed through the door with the battering ram and moved to the side, the first 2 shooters began pushing into the basement apartment. They had not made it fully inside the building before a loud, rushing sound filled the patio, and then a massive orange ball of fire erupted out of the apartment, engulfing everyone in front of the door. The 3 men exposed to the fire stumbled back, falling onto one another, finally getting themselves below the flame, which continued spraying straight out the door all the way up the cement steps to the driveway.
As other team members grabbed the men and pulled them out of the fire, the team leader tried to understand what was happening. All he knew for sure was that a massive cone of flammable propellant was spraying from the apartment through the doorway, and there was no way to make entry here. He had no idea if some sort of booby trap had been tripped, or if the suspect was standing there with a fucking flamethrower, but he knew he had to get his team away from danger so they could regroup. He called into his headset microphone, "Fall back! Fall back!" Cort crawled along next to the hot furnace on his elbows and knees, doing his best to ignore the agonizing pain from the old bullet wound on the right side of his ribcage. After several feet, he was able to climb up to a low crouch. When he was up full and running for the steps out of the basement, he passed the home's main circuit breaker, and he pulled down the lever, enveloping the entire home in darkness. He then ripped out all the fuses, dropped them on the concrete floor, and stomped them till they shattered. He imagined SWAT men would have NODs, night observation devices, but he also imagined they wouldn't have the newest models. Instead, the cops would be looking through narrow tubes that would give them limited peripheral vision, and he hoped to use their weakness to his advantage. He then raced up the stairs, out of the basement, and into the kitchen, his pistol out in front of him. Evacuating the sunken patio outside the basement apartment devolved into utter chaos for the ERT unit. The three men who'd been hit by flame were not seriously injured, but they did not know this yet. More than anything, they were disoriented by the incredible light and heat that had encircled them moments before. The fact that the stairs to the driveway were right in front of the apartment door and therefore still involved in the fire meant everyone had to climb up and over the wall around the patio and onto the driveway, and this was hampered by the three injured men who needed to be helped out, as well as the difficulty in keeping rifles high and at the ready in case the fire stopped and Jeff Duncan charged out of the little room with a weapon in his hand. After nearly 45 seconds, though, all eight ERT officers were up on the driveway and to the side of the unrelenting exhaust of flame, and four of them covered the extraction of the wounded men. More police ran up the driveway to help with the evacuation. By the time everyone was off the Mayberry property and positioned in the street, behind the cover of a pair of armored ERT trucks, the glow from the patio had finally died down. There was concern for a moment as to whether the home itself might have caught fire, but when no evidence of either flame or smoke presented itself after 5 minutes, the ERT team leader called again into his microphone.
"On me! We're going back in!"
The second breach of the basement apartment went much better than the first. The apartment was empty. That was determined quickly, but only after they entered it to find a rolling propane tank with a toy airsoft gun mounted on top of it. A triggering mechanism with an electric lighter and a length of bungee cord completed the improvised automatic flamethrower. The plastic gun had melted into the top of the tank, but the booby trap had proved effective in delaying entry. The propane expelled was primarily vapor, but the compressed gas in the airsoft gun had propelled it outward. The ERT leader couldn't figure out how the suspect could have left the apartment after having set the trap, but he didn't spend too much time thinking about it. Instead, he said,
"He's not here. Let's clear upstairs."
Two teams of eight men each hit the house. Alpha came through the front door and Bravo came through the back near the kitchen. After Alpha cleared the living room and dining room, they left a man in position to cover this area. Bravo cleared the kitchen, a laundry room, and then the basement. They left one of their officers to cover here. The rest of Bravo rallied at the bottom of the stairs with Alpha, who then left an officer here in the hall so he could cover the bottom of the stairs and remain in visual contact with both the man in the front of the house and the man in the back of the house. In this manner, they formed a rear guard, in case an attacker had been missed in the cleared area, or else found some way to double back past the main stack of ERT officers. The remaining members of the two teams moved in a tight train up the stairwell, slowly and carefully, guns high. The Bravo rear guard officer stood on the threshold in the kitchen that led down the stairs to the basement area. The lights were off all over the house, but he used his NODs to see around the space down at the bottom of the stairs. The full 8-man Bravo team had checked the basement, so he wasn't worried about anyone being down there. Instead, he just turned away and kept his eyes up the hallway that led from the kitchen to the stairs, ready to train his rifle on any squirters or suspects trying to flee past the ERT officers still clearing upstairs. This, as it turned out, was a mistake. He never heard the man in stocking feet come up the basement stairs. He only knew someone was there when the pistol's barrel touched his left temple. In a soft whisper, he heard,
"You make a sound into your mic, and I'll blow your fucking head off."
The ERT officer made no sound. As he stood there, still looking up the hallway, he saw the two officers positioned with him on the ground floor look up the hall in his direction, as they checked to make sure he was covering his territory. The three men shared eye contact, but soon enough, the others turned around and moved a few feet into the living room. They were unable to see the tip of the pistol barrel sticking out of the open basement doorway and pressing against the side of their teammate's head. The Bravo officer was pulled by the neck into the basement, then stripped of his rifle, NODs, and communications gear. In the dark, the terrified man heard the door next to him shut softly and a bolt slide into place. Then he was directed by the barrel of the gun against the back of his neck to move down the steps. He followed the whispered instructions, walking all the way back in the direction of the furnace. In the middle of the basement, the suspect pulled the Bravo officer's pistol out of his drop-leg holster. He then heard,
"You have 45 seconds to get everything off. Go."
It was impossible for the ERT officer to get all his gear, his armor, his tunic, his boots, and his pants off in 45 seconds, but he did his best. Court knew he couldn't do it, but he also knew he'd work faster with an impossible timeline. While the man stripped, Court dressed, but he put the man's radio headset in his ear first, so he could listen in. Soon, in a soft voice, he heard,
"This is Alpha One. Hold all positions. We've got a closed closet door in the master bedroom with movement indicated under the door."
Court now had a tunic, body armor, a balaclava, and night vision goggles on.
"Speed it up," Court whispered to the man as the cop fought to get his belt off.
A new call from upstairs came over the radio, asking all elements to report status before they confronted whatever was hiding in the closet. Court spoke to his hostage, who was by now down to his underwear.
"Quick, what's your call sign? Think before you answer. If you're wrong, I drop you right here."
"Bravo 4," the man said.
Court zipped up the black tactical pants while the radio came alive.
"Bravo 1 check. 2 check. Bravo 3 check."
Court clicked the transmit button, but he rubbed his headset mic against the stubble on his chin as he spoke to mask the sound of his voice.
"4 check."
The next man on the team continued the roll call. Court fastened the utility belt around his waist, not taking time to thread the belt through the loops. It was a little large for him, like the rest of the gear, but he made it work. Court then cuffed the ERT officer to a pipe extending from the water heater. Then he pulled a flashbang grenade out of the officer's load-bearing vest. Alpha One stood outside the master bedroom on the second floor of the Mayberry home. Two of his men trained their laser aiming devices on the closet door at the far end of the room. Under the door, faint shadows moved back and forth at irregular intervals. Alpha One shouted,
"DC Metro Police, come out of the closet! Hands high!"
There was no response then, nor when he repeated the command two more times. Finally, Bravo 6 entered the room, moved to the side of the door. He let his rifle hang from its sling and pulled his pistol from his drop-leg holster. Then he used his free hand to reach for the door. Everyone else tightened for action, their laser pointers evenly spaced across the door as Bravo 6 slid it open. On the floor in the back of the closet, a flashlight stuck out of a woman's shoe. In front of this was a huge puddle of milk, and around the puddle, three cats moved around, lapping it up hungrily.
"Son of a bitch," the ERT man mumbled.
A flashbang grenade went off on the ground floor below them. The four regular police officers watching the backyard of the house from the neighbor's yard saw the flash of light in the windows. The explosion broke glass in the kitchen that flew out over the patio. As they knelt behind a fence and watched, they heard in their radios the calls of the tactical team as they lined up on the second-floor stairs, ready to hit the floor below them from the stairwell. It was clear they were missing a man, but these four in back understood why. A single tactical officer, his rifle in his left hand and his right hand clutching his left elbow, appeared in the side yard. The cops thought he might have come either from the front of the house or the basement apartment. He ran up to them. Clearly he was hurt, but at least he was ambulatory. While one of the cops made the officer down call, the other three covered for the wounded ERT man as he ran past their position, all the way through the yard and towards the street on the other side of this property. None of the men noticed the cop was wearing a backpack that was not police issue. One of the officers started to run to help him, but he was called back by the other three. They knew they needed to hold their position in case the suspect appeared and tried to run after the fight inside. Court ran to the street, where two police cars sat parked on the corner. The cars were both empty, with their doors open, but four armed officers stood nearby, ready to block any traffic trying to get into the neighborhood.
"Ambulance is on the way," one cop called out when he saw the tactical officer. "How bad is it?"
Court was all the way up to the two vehicles when he slowed and stopped. He let go of his arm now and raised the rifle.
"Show me your hands."
"What the hell?"
"Where are the keys?"
No one spoke. They were all clearly stunned. Court glanced in one of the cruisers and saw the keys in the ignition.
"Drop your weapons on the street. Kick them away."
All four did as instructed, and Court leapt into the cruiser, fired it up, and then raced off. He knew this drive would be a short one. The helicopter pilot above would be informed of the situation in seconds, and it wasn't tough for a cop in the sky to track a cop car on an empty street. He pulled under a covered parking space in an apartment complex just 7.5 blocks away, parked the squad car, and leapt out, leaving the rifle behind. Just as the helo above neared his position, he sprinted through the parking lot. Then he climbed the fence and dropped down into a drainage canal that ran at the back of the apartment complex. He knew where he was going, after having studied satellite maps of his neighborhood to plan for rushed escapes. He raced along the canal, ran to a large culvert, and ducked in. As he moved through pitch darkness, he pulled out his phone to light his way, and with this, he saw a smaller drain, waist high, and not more than 4 feet in diameter. That ran off at a 90-degree angle. Water gushed down from it into the culvert. This wasn't sewage, it was just runoff water from the streets, but there wasn't anything clean about it. Court climbed up and into the long, narrow shaft, and he knelt low. This killed his wounded ribs, but he ignored the pain and moved as fast as he could from the area. He wasn't sure where the drain went, this wasn't on the sat maps, but he had a flashlight, and he had a sense that he was moving to the east. If he just stayed in here for a few blocks and climbed out, he'd find himself somewhere in the middle of the city, and from there, he was sure he would be safe from the immediate threat.
Chapter 50.
Denny Carmichael opened this morning's copy of the Washington Post. Dorenzi had brought it in as soon as it arrived by courier, and Denny had been awake and waiting for it, even though it was only 5 a.m. It took him no time to find the article he was looking for, just below the fold and taking up an entire half of the front page, as well as another half of A19. Carmichael assumed Catherine King must have raced back from the CIA headquarters in McLean to the Washington Post's office in D.C. to make her deadline last night. She couldn't have possibly filed the story before midnight, which meant the newspaper had done some impressive work to get the article in the edition that went to press just a few hours later. It was all there, under the headline, CIA suspects D.C. area shooter is known personality. The description of Gentry was close to what Carmichael had handed King. She'd also reported the fact that he had spent time in Miami, along with information that he'd been trained, possibly by jihadists, likely in Yemen. For some reason, there was no mention about him coming from Jacksonville, Florida, but Denny wasn't too troubled by this. nor was he bothered by the fact that King's article clearly faulted CIA for not letting police know after the Brandywine Street incident that they had suspicions about who might be involved in the attack. Carmichael didn't care. After all, in one form or another, CIA had been blamed for everything bad that had happened ever since the 1950s. Other than this small trifle, there was very little editorial comment from King in the piece, which greatly pleased Denny. She did add a small caveat at the end when she wrote that the investigation was ongoing and first reports, even from top government officials, often proved to be erroneous. Carmichael shrugged. King thought she had couched her piece with skepticism, but she had done exactly what Denny wanted her to do. She had published an article that would bait Gentry into targeting the writer of the article. At any other time, the impenetrable blackness around him and the rainfall beating against the aluminum roof above him would have lulled Court into peaceful sleep. But his heart rate and the adrenaline pumping through him even now, a full hour and a half after listening to the sounds of a tactical unit preparing to smash in his door, still prevented him from calming down enough to relax and doze off. He sat Indian style in his small storage unit, his back to the concrete block back wall, his suppressed Glock in his lap, and his Yamaha motorcycle right in front of him for cover. He faced the closed metal sliding door, stared at the black in front of his eyes, and listened to the calming rain. And he fully expected at any moment for the door to fly open and a team of shooters to rush in behind it with blinding lights and laser-targeting devices. Court had made it to his storage unit over half an hour earlier, after running a short SDR by using two early morning cabs and walking through back alleys and commercial parking lots. Once in his little unit, he checked the area around him before closing the door. Then he used the light of his phone to find his second bug-out bag here in his cache, and to check the bike to make sure it was ready to roll. Then he just sat down and did his best to relax. He hadn't known who was hitting the Mayberry house at first, but after the engagement he determined they were a local police tactical unit. Their body armor said ERT, and while that was nothing conclusive, a gang of Arab goons had worn uniforms that proclaimed them to be DC Metro cops after all, the tactical unit's movements confirmed to Court that they were exactly what they purported to be. The cordon of regular patrol officers in the area around the Mayberry home only sealed Court's suspicion he'd been discovered in his hide site by local law enforcement. That was a bit embarrassing for a Tier 1 operator like Gentry, but he'd known from the beginning he would be up against a lot of different opposition forces, and he'd be taking a risk operating inside the city. If the cops hit this storage locker now, he would lift the Glock and he would point it at them, but he wasn't about to kill a cop. He might squeeze off a couple of rounds into their body armor just to make himself feel good, but there was nowhere to run, so if the cops hit, he'd die right here, sitting Indian style, and enjoying the sound of the morning spring rain. But he wasn't just barricading himself here to die. Instead, he was waiting a few minutes more for the early part of the morning rush hour, where he wouldn't be one of the only vehicles out on the street, and then he would climb aboard the Yamaha 650 and get the hell out of town. But not too far. Despite this morning's setback, he still had work to do here in the district. For now, he just worked on calming his body, relaxing himself, and waiting for the right time to run. Matt Hanley was the last to enter the conference room, and as soon as he did so, he realized the meeting had begun without him. Not that he cared. If he had his way, he wouldn't be here at all, but he'd been summoned by Carmichael, and Carmichael was his superior, so he had no choice but to attend. As he sat down at the table in an open wingback chair, he looked around at the attendees. Suzanne Brewer was in the middle of a presentation. She stood in front of a digital map of the city and addressed the room, perfectly coiffed and dressed. Mays and Carmichael were present, of course, as were many of the other Violator Working Group members, along with a team of techs sitting in chairs against the back wall. And there was one more attendee. Down at the end of the conference table sat a big man with short blonde hair, much of it turning gray. He wore a suit and tie, his face was cleanly shaved, and he had a small notebook in front of him. But Hanley wasn't fooled. He knew a shooter when he saw one. Hanley turned away from the man, presuming him to be a JSOC liaison or someone similar, but as soon as Brewer finished her presentation and sat back down, Hanley's head swiveled back to the man at the end of the table. Matt hadn't seen Zach Hightower in 5 years, and he was almost certain he'd never seen him without a beard, so he forgave himself for not recognizing him. Calling out across the length of the table, he said,
"Morning, Sierra One. Welcome back to the land of the living."
Zach Hightower had worked for Matt Hanley for several years, till the day Hanley was told all the men in his goon squad unit were dead, except for Gentry, and Gentry was the culprit for the deaths of the others.
"Hey, Matt,"
Zach said. He seemed embarrassed to be alive. He added,
"Sorry about that."
Zach then nodded over to Denny Carmichael, who was looking down at some papers. He shrugged.
"Orders, you know."
Hanley just stared Hightower down and said,
"Your funeral sucked, by the way."
Zach gave a half-smile and looked down to his empty notebook, and one of the techs in the room, a man who had no idea what was going on, broke out in a surprised laugh. The executives at the conference table, in contrast, remained silent, until Suzanne Brewer said,
"Matt, you haven't missed anything. I was just getting started with the morning briefing. The short version is this. Gentry's in the wind. Again. Local PD had him, but they lost him."
Hanley asked, "How did that happen?"
"While 40 cops cordoned off the neighborhood, 2 8-man ERT units hit the house where he was staying. They engaged Gentry, but Gentry managed to get out of the building and pass the cordon."
Hanley said, "Let's see. Yesterday in DuPont Circle, Gentry brutally murdered several men. The death toll this morning must have been 3 times that, right?"
Brewer shook her head, not picking up on the fact that Hanley seemed to know the answer to this question already.
"Surprisingly, no. 4 men were injured, though no injuries were life-threatening."
Hanley glanced to Hightower, and he noticed his eyebrows furrowing slightly, but Zach said nothing. Hanley next asked,
"Could someone please tell me why I'm here?"
Carmichael spoke for the first time since Hanley had arrived.
"Like it or not, Matt, it's in your best interests that we bring this episode to a close. Suzanne wants to know where Violator will go next for shelter. Today, we suspect, will be a repositioning day for him. He will find some new location, some new bolt hole, and I'm going to venture to guess it will be outside of the district, someplace safer. You ran the man for several years, and he hasn't been back in the area since those days. We thought you might give us ideas about his possible new hide site."
Before Hanley could respond, Hightower raised a wary hand. Brewer turned to acknowledge him.
"Zach, it's not necessary to raise your hand."
"Sorry," he said. "Gentry will be south of D.C., in a remote location. Picture a covered ditch, a deserted cabin, a grain elevator on an abandoned farm. He will be very difficult to find once he gets there, almost impossible. I feel our next moment of opportunity will be when he re-engages us, not when we discover his hide."
Brewer said,
"I understand why you think he will go somewhere more remote, but why south specifically?"
"He lived and worked in Northern Virginia. It's more familiar to him. He might anticipate us making this assumption, but he is confident in his abilities to hide, especially when he knows the terrain."
Carmichael pointed to Hanley.
"Your best guess as to his location?"
Hanley heaved his shoulders, not hiding his annoyance at it all.
"I was management. Hightower was labor. Next to Court Gentry, Zach Hightower is the best operator I ever had working under me."
He looked down the table at Hightower.
"Before Zach's untimely death, he was also the best ground-level leader I'd ever seen. In your infinite wisdom, Denny, you've resurrected Hightower to sit him in a 7th-floor conference room, dress him in a suit and tie, and ask him questions about Gentry's new lair. Zach tells you the target has run someplace you'll never find him, so I defer to Zach's expertise. I guess you'll just have to wait for him to come back out to play."
Suzanne snapped back, play, Matt? Really? A veteran CIA official and 3 innocent transit police were murdered yesterday. I doubt their loved ones see this as a game.
Hanley sniffed. Yeah, about that. Yesterday, a man with Court Gentry's abilities of escape and evasion was so backed into a corner in a location with 6 egresses that he was forced to murder 3 poorly armed and poorly trained transit cops in cold blood, in broad daylight, in a crowded location. And yet before dawn this morning, 16 highly trained tactical officers raided his secure, defended ground, and in that instance, Court only knocks a few heads together. Killing none. 0.
Hanley was looking at Hightower now.
That is pretty damn curious, wouldn't you say?
Despite Hanley's challenge, Zack did not say a word. Brewer countered. He did a lot more than knock heads together.
Hanley stood up from the table. But he did a lot less than send 12 poor bastards to the morgue. A cold-blooded killer is cornered like a fucking rat in a cage and he doesn't kill his way out.
He turned to Denny.
Not buying it. I'm not buying any of this bullshit. I'm walking, Chief. You have a problem with that? Go to the director and have him remove me for insubordination. The way the walls are crumbling around here, you'd be doing me a favor.
Carmichael didn't stop Hanley from leaving, but Brewer chased him out and caught up with him on his way back to his office.
Matt?
With a heave and a sigh, he turned back to her.
Sorry, Suzanne. My comments weren't directed at you, specifically. They were directed at this entire operation.
I understand. I just don't understand why you are in Gentry's camp the way you are. Hightower is the same way. Zack will do whatever we tell him to do. It seems clear he is a good soldier. But I don't get the feeling his heart is in this any more than yours is.
Hanley said. Every day this goes on, Denny gets himself in deeper. I don't know what the fuck is happening out there, but the story he is giving you, and the story he gave the Washington Post yesterday, is just the story Denny needs us to believe. It's not the truth. I respect you, Suzanne. But when the smoke clears after this debacle, those of us who did what we could to stay outside of Denny's gravitational pull will not be able to do one damn thing to help those who got pulled down with him.
Hanley left Brewer there, standing alone in the hallway. Chapter 51. Court opened up the throttle on his Yamaha 650 as soon as he turned south on I-95. He wasn't sure where he was going, only that he needed to get the hell out of D.C., at least for the time being. He planned on finding a new hide, somewhere within 30 minutes to 1 hour's drive of the district, and someplace 1 hell of a lot more secure than Arthur Mayberry's basement apartment. Although he wasn't sure where he was going, he wasn't exactly flying blind. He knew this stretch of highway, because the HQ of the Goon Squad had been in Norfolk, and he'd lived in Virginia Beach, both just to the southeast. He'd driven up I-95 to D.C. from time to time on training evolutions, either to practice surveillance in Old Town Alexandria or around the National Mall near the Capitol building. He passed Prince William Forest Park on his right, the Marine Barracks of Quantico on his left, and he continued another few minutes until he saw a turnoff for the Stafford Regional Airport. Instantly, an idea came to him. Court had learned to fly light aircraft here a long time ago, admittedly, but he remembered the facility more or less. Security had been lax around the airport at the time, so he thought there was a chance he could hide out somewhere on the property, either in a hangar or a utility room, or perhaps even in the comfort of a private aircraft. It was a thin plan, because he hadn't visited the location in some 15 years, but he knew if he continued on too much longer, he'd be in Fredericksburg, and he had no intention of setting up his new hide in a developed area. He exited I-95 and headed towards the airport. As soon as he began riding along the chain-link fence to the airport property, he decided his impromptu plan wasn't going to pan out like he'd hoped. It was a small airfield with only 1 runway and just 6 or so buildings, and security appeared much tighter than what he remembered. He knew he could wait till nightfall and gain access to the grounds, but it wasn't yet 9 a.m., and he did not want to waste an entire day lying low, only to spend the whole evening developing a new hide.
No. Court had things to do. He needed to find a new home right now, so that tonight he could act.
Once he passed the airport, he started to turn around to head back to I-95, but a lonely gravel road off to his right caught his eye. He didn't see a single structure on either side of the road, only oak and pine and thick brush. But he imagined the road led to some place where no one would be looking for him, and for now, at least, that was good enough. Court remembered flying low over these woods all those years ago. His flight instructor, a retired Air Force jet jockey who taught single-engine piloting to CIA operators, had pointed out the roofs of a few wooden houses far away from any noticeable roads. He'd told Court that there had once been a Civil War camp in the woods, and a few broken-down battlements and other structures remained from that era. Now Court wondered if he could find the old buildings and use them as some sort of shelter. After only a few minutes of driving north on the gravel road, the sky opened up and heavy rain began to fall again. He saw a narrow gravel footpath that led off the road, and not a soul in sight, so he made the turn, driving deeper now into the forest. Another 2 minutes on the road, and he found himself looking for any access into the dense woods so he could get under the protection of a tree and out of the rain. But as he peered deep in the woods, he saw, on both sides of the footpath, low stone fences that looked like they were at least from the Civil War era, if not well before. He continued on because he wouldn't be able to get his bike up and over the stone barriers. The path ran along a creek and then ended at the remnants of a washed-out wooden footbridge over the water. A sign on a pole told Court this was Accokeek Creek, and the 11th Union Army had spent the winter of 1863 camped nearby. Court's interest in the Civil War was surpassed by his interest in survival, so he worried he might have wandered into some sort of historic park that attracted visitors. But if he had, he was all but certain he'd come in through a back entrance, and he had the distinct impression there was no one around for miles. Court turned off his bike's engine and rolled it to the creek's edge, then began pushing it upstream along the bank to get around the stone fence and find some cover from the storm. He found the woods thicker here than he'd first thought, so he continued moving on the creek's edge, knowing he had succeeded in finding a remote location in which to hide, but wondering if he had overachieved by getting too far away from civilization to be practical. He'd been in search of a roof, and it seemed now he'd have to settle for a fallen tree or maybe just foliage with thick leaves. His mood darkened with the frustration growing in him. After a time, he found evidence of an old set of stone stairs rising out of the creek and up a hill. They were barely visible under the brush along the creek bed, but it made him wonder if more development was close by. He pushed himself and his motorcycle up into the woods and away from the water. As he climbed, he saw that, although this path had long ago been cleared of trees, it had not been used in some time, and the farther he got from the creek, the deeper the grasses and foliage grew. He'd gone no more than 50 feet when, ahead and off to the right of the overgrown path, he saw something big looming in the woods. He looked closer, then he rubbed rainwater out of his eyes to do a double take. It was a 2-story building, covered with vines and surrounded by oak trees. The first floor seemed to be made of stacked stone, and the second floor and the steeply pitched roof were wood plank, much of it bowed or rotten. Court left his bike where it was and pushed into the trees to investigate the building. The door had a lock on it, but that wasn't going to slow Court down, because the door was lying on its side on the porch, 10 feet from where it had once been affixed in the doorway. The stone steps up to the porch were covered in vines, but good and solid. Not so the porch itself, which sagged down several inches when he stepped on it. He moved along the edges until he found a crossbeam under the rotten wood, then walked along this like a tightrope to the door. He stepped through the doorway and into a large, dark room. This was an abandoned grain mill, he could tell from the setup. It was at least as old as the Civil War battlements supposedly out here in the forest, but probably unrelated to the 1863 encampment of Union forces. The big, dark room was open to the elements because of all the windows and the missing door, and he could hear dripping rainwater here inside, but the roof high above him seemed mostly intact. He pulled his flashlight from his pack and walked the beam all along the inside. A small amount of graffiti on the wall and the beams above, and a larger amount of 20th-century trash, told him he hadn't discovered anything that had not been discovered hundreds of times by others, but he had serious doubts anyone happened by here with any regularity. It was a roof over his head, and it was nothing if not secluded, but this wasn't going to be comfortable, at least not until he scrounged up a few more items. He looked at his watch. It had taken him a little less than an hour to travel here from D.C., which made this a suitable location as far as he was concerned. This was now home. He dropped his pack against the wall and changed into dry blue jeans and a mostly dry dark gray thermal shirt. He didn't have any more socks other than the ones he was wearing, which, like his tennis shoes, were soaking wet, so he just told himself to forget about any real comfort and be glad for what he had. When he was settled in, meaning sitting on a raincoat with his back against the wall, a tiny fire for warmth in front of him, he pulled out his smartphone and began calling up CNN and a few newswire services on the Internet. It took him fewer than 5 minutes of surfing to come across the Washington Post article, purporting to have information about a homegrown terrorist targeting the Central Intelligence Agency. Court almost ignored it, thinking it was going to be nothing more than a bunch of bullshit conjecture, just like everything he'd seen during the daytime hours of CNN and the other cable networks, a bunch of people who knew nothing about the event pontificating just to fill airtime. But quickly, he realized the writer of this article had spoken with CIA personnel. Key personnel, in fact. Soon, Court was certain Denny Carmichael had been involved in the background interview the reporter cited as her principal source. He read through to the end of the article, and now Court's jaw muscles tensed, and he looked up from his screen, furious. They were making him out to be nothing more than a delusional psycho who held an imaginary grudge against the CIA, who then bumbled over to the Middle East for training and support before returning home to begin his reign of terror. Court scrolled back up to the top of the article, looking for the byline. Catherine King. An email address and phone number were listed as well. Court decided he wanted to talk to King to find out about the access she'd been granted and the people she'd interviewed. This might help him learn of others involved in his situation, someone he could target next. But Court knew something else as well. The CIA had planted intel in the article so that he would do just that. Court shook his head in disbelief. All these years, all this cat and mouse, and Denny Carmichael still thought Court was just some knuckle-dragging door-kicker, not smart enough to see he was being set up. Court smiled a little and decided he wouldn't go after Catherine King. No, not yet. He would instead go after whoever it was tailing Catherine King, hoping it would be the same group of Arabs he'd been up against since at least the night he witnessed Leland Babbitt's murder. If the CIA was using foreign operatives here in the U.S., Court felt they would be at the center of the reasons behind his targeting. He'd love to get a hold of some of these men after him, to squeeze them for intelligence, because they would surely have the answers. He'd speak with King later if he needed to, but for now, he would seek out the hunters on his trail, because in Court's long career, he had learned one lesson above all. It's no big trick to turn a predator into prey. Chapter 52. Catherine King parked on the cobblestone street, just steps from the front door of her O Street two-story Federalist home, and climbed out of her bright blue Prius. She retrieved her purse, her briefcase, and her yoga mat from the back seat. Then she headed inside without a glance at the street around her. Zach Hightower watched her through the Leupold scope affixed to his collapsible sniper rifle. Once she was inside her front door, he scanned the length of O Street, looking for any idling vehicles in the area. Seeing nothing of interest, he began training his optic on the lighted windows in the nearby apartment buildings. Zack had no trouble admitting to himself that the Georgetown neighborhood of Washington, D.C. was a shitty place to set up a sniper's hide, but he was confident he'd found the absolute best location to secrete himself. He was on the roof of Gaston Hall, part of a massive neo-Gothic seven-story structure that served as the focal point of Georgetown University. From here, he had a perfect vantage point for 200 yards down the length of O Street, as well as many portions of various cross streets in a four-block area. 80 feet off his right shoulder was the clock tower of Healy Hall. The tower was several stories higher than his position here, and he could have made his way up there to set up his operation. It would have given him sight lines on more rooftops, street corners, and windows, and with any other target, Zack would have plopped his ass right in that tower so he could have as many opportunities to see his target from distance as possible. But not today. No. Right now, he was hunting Sierra 6, and 6 was the smartest prey Zack had ever tracked. The clock tower was an obvious place for a sniper to position himself, and Six would see it the second he arrived in the vicinity of Catherine King's home. Six would spend as much time as he needed hiding out, using all sorts of gadgets and tactics to get a look up at the obvious hide site, and if Zack put himself in the clock tower, Six would know it, and Zack would be dead fucking meat. Zack liked his chances here on the rooftop. This building was attached to Healy Hall to make an L-shaped structure the width and length of a city block. There were hundreds of square yards of territory up here, much of it steep, but there were also standing seams and walkways far enough back from the building's edge to allow him to avoid silhouetting himself. And there were dormers and crosses and antennae and satellite dishes and other bits of cover and concealment available to where Zack felt he was completely invisible from ground level. Zack agreed with the assessment of Jordan Mays. Gentry would come for Catherine King, looking to find out just who she'd spoken with and just what she knew. And at the speed Gentry's operation had been progressing, Zack could well imagine he would make his move tonight. If that happened, Zack put his chances at nearly 100% that he'd see his target from this position. He knew how Gentry thought and how he moved, and he was damn certain he knew where Gentry would go, even to the point of which backyards around here he'd skulk through on his way towards his objective. And Zack and his rifle would be ready. He didn't feel any better about taking out Court Gentry now than he did when he told Brewer that she was playing for the wrong team in all this, but that wouldn't slow Zack down for an instant. If he saw his target, he would put a bullet through it, just the same as he would if he were taking pot shots at the practice range. He had been using the street lights to see around O Street, but now he decided to dig deeper with his optic, to look into the recesses of alleyways and shady door stoops, to check blackened buildings and dim rooftops. He reached into his big backpack and pulled out his universal night sight. Made by FLIR Systems, it attached just forward of his regular optic on the rail of his rifle. After turning it on, he simply looked through his Leupold dayscope, and a television image of the scene below him enhanced all the light in the area so he could see deep into the darkest shadows. He had to avoid pointing the night sight at the bright lights on the street, but for the areas away from lights, the device was ideal. Zack scanned the rooftops of the neighborhood carefully. It was still early, probably way too early for Gentry to move, but he had wanted to arrive here in his position well before employing his weapon. He needed time to memorize the surroundings, to make a mental snapshot he could refer to at any point during his hunt. He'd finished a narrow scan of O Street and had just begun to move away from the rooftops on 35th Street Northwest when he noticed a faint flash of light coming from a building on the southwest corner of 35th and O. Everything in the area, save for the streetlights and a few windows, was dark or close to it, so the flare had stood out, especially since it seemed to come from the roof of an otherwise blacked-out building. Zack angled his scope down to street level so he could see what type of structure he was looking at, and saw the building housed a coffee shop, which was closed for the evening. There. Another faint flash. He could tell it was definitely coming from the flat rooftop above the coffee shop. Like the last time, it was gone just as soon as it appeared. With his 9 power scope, he couldn't see the exact source of the light, but in his pack next to him he carried a pair of one of the best binoculars on the planet. He reached in quickly, retrieved his Swarovski Optic SLC-56, and brought the long binos to his eyes. He steadied them by resting his elbows on the standing seam roof below him, and brought them into focus on the corner of O and 35th Street Northwest. Through the 15-power magnification, he scanned the rooftop of the coffee shop where he'd noticed the light before. Another flash, just to the right of his field of view. He shifted his binos to center them on the location.
What the hell?
He could just barely make out a smartphone lying by itself, face up, on top of the roof, slightly angled up toward Zack's hide. In seconds, he saw another flash and realized the intermittent lights were due to incoming text messages. He sighed. He'd gotten his hopes up for nothing. It looked like some asshole had thrown the phone from the street up onto the roof, God knows why, and now someone else was texting the owner. Zack started to put his binos up and return to the search, but he paused a moment. Inside his pack, he put his hand around his spotter scope, already affixed to a tiny tripod. On a whim, he pulled it out, set it up next to his rifle, and peered through it. It took him several seconds to line it up with the rooftop, and then zoom its variable 125-power magnification to the smartphone, but when he did, it was like he was looking at the screen from a distance of only 1.5 yards. He realized he'd be able to read any more text that came through. Just then, the phone flashed. Hightower squinted into the eye cup of his spotter scope, straining to see the text message. "How's it hanging, Zack? You still got that obnoxious 125x scope?" Slowly, Zack Hightower pulled his eye out of the cup of the spotter scope, and he placed his forehead on the cold metal roof.
"You're right up here with me, aren't you, Six?"
From 10 yards behind him, Hightower heard a voice he knew well.
"Figured I'd find some asshole up here. Can't say I expected you. Thought you were dead."
Zack's elbows were tight under his body, his forehead still lying flat on the roof. While keeping his arms perfectly still, he moved the fingers of his right hand under the collar of his black tunic. He took hold of a throwing knife attached to a necklace, but he did not pull it free from its sheath.
Zack said, "Just up here hunting old ghosts, bro."
"Me too," replied Court. "I've got a gun on you, in case you've forgotten. I don't miss very often. Whatever you are thinking about doing, just know that."
Zack nodded to himself. Then he said,
"I figure I've got a 50-50 chance."
"You give yourself too much credit."
Zack shrugged. Then he launched his body to the right by pressing his left arm and left knee into the roof with all his might. Court fired a single suppressed round, and the bullet slammed into the midsection of Zack's Kevlar chest protection just as he rolled onto his back. Zack's right arm shot down from his neck. In one motion, he yanked the folding knife free of the scabbard. The scabbard itself opened the blade, and he hurled it across the dark roof in the direction of the flash of gunfire. Zack saw his target react, contorting his body to the left, and the spinning knife flew just past Court's face, missing him by less than a foot. Zack absorbed the baseball bat punch to the solar plexus from the round hitting his Kevlar, and he snatched his HK pistol out of the drop holster on his right hip. He brought it up to fire on his target, just in time to see the dark figure tumble backwards, down onto the tiles of the roof. He heard the pistol bounce along on its own, clanging down and then off of the 7-story building. But he didn't know if Gentry himself had fallen down the sloped roof. Zack sprang to his knees, keeping his pistol trained on the last place he'd seen his target, and he moved laterally a few yards, careful not to appear over the roof's edge exactly where Gentry would expect him. Slowly, he moved to the end of the flat standing seam and looked down at the angled tile roof. It was dark below. He could make out little, other than the trees in the courtyard at the back of the building. Right in front of him, just as the roof began to increase in pitch, was a small platform for a satellite dish, an old VHF antenna, and, alongside the VHF, Zack saw a curious-looking metal bar that came up from the platform with wires attached to it. The bar went up about 1 foot, then bowed down and angled out of sight, down the side of the roof. Zack took one more step forward to look on the other side of the platform, his gun up and ready, in case Gentry was hiding there. He wasn't. Zack then looked farther down the steeply angled roof. There, 10 feet below him, he saw a figure lying against the tile. He held something in both hands. At the exact same instant, Hightower realized Gentry was holding on to the long radio antenna, bending it down at an impossible angle. Gentry let go, and the bent metal aerial torqued upwards at high speed. After a brief whipping sound, the antenna smacked Zack Hightower right between his eyes, sending him flying backwards, end over end, tumbling along the flat part of the roof. His HK-6